Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 65 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer. Bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming. News and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. It's been another great week in the gaming capital of the world. Cody, how's it going?
Good. The listeners have come to expect the weather report, and we have skipped spring altogether here in the gaming capital and moved deftly into summer.
Directly into summer, mm-hmm. Although the rain has returned a little bit today.
A little bit.
And yesterday. Which makes you happy.
Yes.
Rainy guy that you
That's
are.
That's right.
But the sun is going to be coming out. And
tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar.
So, but while the sun is still hidden from us, there are lots of games to play. And Cody, what are we talking about this episode? A little diversion from maybe what you might have heard at the end of last episode.
That's right.
Just saying.
We were planning to bring you a choo-choo-choosy train game episode. I'm just going to roll through that.
Yikes.
But we had to push some things back due to some scheduling issues that came up, but instead we're
keep your ticket
because
you can redeem it later for a yes. later episode, which will involve train games.
Yes. Train thing there we got them all out of the way.
Clever girl.
I'm going to get off the rails here. We're actually going to be doing an episode on Cold War games.
You wouldn't think there'd be a whole lot of those, but
no,
we found at least three.
Yeah, Gorbachev's birthmark, the role-playing game.
Exactly.
No, but we're going to bring you three very different games that all have this Cold War theme. We're going to be talking about Cold War KGB versus CIA, a nice Silver Line game from Fantasy Flight. The Big Daddy, the number one rated game on Board Game Geek, if I'm correct.
Currently, I believe so, yes.
Yes, Twilight Struggle, and the new hotness from Stronghold Games, Confusion.
Yes, Confusion, Espionage, and Deception in the Cold War.
Yep, and we want to give a shout-out to our good buddy Jeremy D. Salinas, a.k.a. Drakenstrike, for helping us out and loaning us his advanced copy so we could review it.
www.drakenstrikevideos.com.
Thanks. But we've got that, the game on Inbox, and a whole host of other things, but we're going to start the rundown right
now. All right, it's time for the rundown, where we're going to talk about all the great stuff we've been doing in gaming the last couple of weeks. But first, we want to do our due penance and give our due homage to Myriad Games, our great sponsor. Myriad Games sponsors Game On with Cody and John on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. And as we mentioned a lot, you know, their MVP membership is a great thing to get involved with, where you're able to kind of budget your gaming dollar for the month, and you get lots of great bonuses. You know, Cody and I participate in that every month, and you know, even though we're remote and we're not in New Hampshire where they're based, still a lot of great stuff and a great way to sort of. It feels like free money, I think, you know, for me. I know it's coming out of the bank account, but it's just like it comes out of the bank account every month, so I never really I don't really notice it because I've already budgeted it.
Yeah, and the nice thing is that even if you're not a local customer of Myriad Games, you can work out a package with them. They have kind of a nice a la carte system where you can pick the perks that work for you, and you can stretch your gaming dollar to its maximum extent.
And I just got a copy in our recent shipment of... I think it's pronounced Troyes. Or as we say in Indiana, Troyes. new Euro game from Z-Man Games that's a first time coming over to the United States with a U.S. distributor. That one's gotten a lot of real great press since Essen last year, so we'll definitely be giving that one a go in the next few weeks. So great stuff from Myriad Games. Check them out. Oh, also check out their podcast, Myriad Games Presentations, where they just finished their 150th episode.
Nicely done.
Lots of great
I believe that gets
there.
It. Well done.
Yeah, well done. Good job.
Well done.
We'll get there eventually.
No.
One show per day. You know? No. All right, so let's talk about what we've been playing. Cody, you want to start the rundown?
Sure. I got a chance to play. I was at the last Game On Game Night and got another racing game to the table, Das Motorsportspiel.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was interesting.
That sounds made up.
Yeah, it sounds like a fake game, but it was all right. It wasn't my favorite racing game. I've played a few, you know, notably Rally Man and Detroit Cleveland Grand Prix, but it was fine. It had a huge kind of rolled out board.
Yeah, it came in a tube, right?
Yeah, it came in a big like poster tube. And it had, you know, these scale little metal cars that...
Yeah, like the size of Matchbox cars like Matchbox are a little bit bigger. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, so that was neat. Got to play that. You and I and a few others played World Without End.
Yeah, they're a sequel to Pillars of the Earth.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as far as Euros go, that's one I'll play. It's not my favorite just because it... I don't know.
It didn't seem like it landed real well for you this past time.
No, it wasn't my favorite game, but it was okay.
I lost horribly in that game.
Yeah, you didn't do well. You didn't even, like, you ended with, like, 7 points, right?
And you start the game with 8. You
start with 8.
Yeah, I did great.
That's a nice hour's work right there. Let's see. I got a 3-Dragon Ante to the table.
Oh, wow.
Recently, and that's still a good game. I mean, that's one I want to take to an old bar or something, and around a wooden table. You know, that would be neat. But got to play that, and also got to teach a few of my friends Memoir 44.
Oh,
which is a game that it sits on my shelf and I don't really think about it, and then every time I pull it out, it's just like, man, I need to be playing this more.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a huge war game guy, and that may be about as much war game as I want to handle. And about half the war gamers listening just had a heart attack. But I really enjoy it. It's just such a clean game, and I get what I want out of a war game playing that.
Yeah, and I think those Overlord scenarios are pretty good too. We've never had an opportunity to. I've done it at Origins, but mm-hmm. I've never really gotten a group of folks together to play a big, you know, 3-on-3 battle. But that one's a lot of fun, too.
We should do that at one of the game nights if I know I'm going to be there ahead of time.
Oh, yeah.
And schedule a big Overlord game.
Oh, Sean would love that. Yeah. So, cool.
A few other, two other games I want to mention that I'm going to go in-depth a little more into is I got a chance to play Code 777, the deduction game from Stronghold Games.
Yeah.
And this one I took with me to my in-laws and played that there. And I was pleasantly surprised because I didn't really think I would care for the deduction game that much.
I didn't think you'd like it either. I mean, when you came back and said that you liked it, I was really surprised.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, it was to kind of summarize it. It doesn't take much to summarize it. It's a game where you have 3 tiles in front of you that have numbers from 1 to 7, and they're different colored tiles. And you're trying to guess what 3 numbers are in front of you. You cannot see your numbers, but all of your opponents can, and Ooh. Vice versa. And so each round you're going to be drawing from a deck of questions that say, you know, do I see more blue 7s or do I see more 4s? You know, I don't think that's an actual question, but
okay.
But questions like that. And so based on the answers you're getting and what you can see, you're going to kind of narrowing things down and getting to what you think your 3 numbers are. Mm-hmm. And if you make a correct guess, then you get a point. If not, then your tiles in front of you go away. You don't get to see them, and then you get 3 new tiles.
Oh, and that must suck because then you've lost a lot of your mm-hmm. information that you had from your previous question.
So not only you have to start over, but your opponents get more information because they get 3 new tiles.
Oh, yeah.
And so we played a few games of this, and it was just that perfect level of deduction and brain burn for me. It's like, really? You really have to think this one out. I mean, it's not just you can't check your brain at the door, but it's just really nice because there's just a lot of thought going into it, and you know, there's a certain level of chance, you know, whether have you narrowed it down enough to make a guess. And mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. And one nice feature is that it's colorblind friendly. It says, says it on the box.
Oh.
And so they have like shapes with each of the colors, you know, because I'm colorblind. So it's sometimes hard for me to, you know, without being embarrassing, you don't want to break the game.
Right.
You know, were there more blue 7s? Well, I don't know. so that was really nice. And the... Stephen Bonacore from Stronghold Games, he actually included some of the score sheets that you can print out off of their website and off of Board Game Geek that are a little better than the ones that come in the box.
Oh, nice.
And I would recommend those. Those are definitely a lot better. But
yeah.
It was a big hit with everyone I played it. My father-in-law went out and bought it the next day.
Wow.
Which is strange for him, I think.
I don't know, it's true.
That impulsive. So mm-hmm. Code 777, definitely give it a shot. This is one that kind of went under my radar, but... I think it's going to be a big hit in my collection, so I'm going to be keeping that one.
Great. Well, I need to play it then. I haven't played it yet. So
yeah, absolutely.
Let's get that one to the table. Cool.
The other game I wanted to mention is I've been running a D&D 4th edition game. I've been enjoying it. We're kind of running, like I mentioned last episode, a shortened one, just a heroic tier game. But I've been reading more and more about a game called Castles and Crusades, and I've brought it up on the show before. It's from a small company called Troll Lord Games. They're based out of Arkansas. That's about the only game company based out of Arkansas I've ever heard of.
Yeah.
But I've been looking at their stuff. Basically, Castles and Crusades, it's a riff on this kind of old school renaissance of gaming with fantasy games. But so it takes kind of like that D&D first edition feel, but it has rule systems from more modern systems, because it's basically, it has the D20 OGL license, albeit it's pretty stripped down slash different from that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so imagine just first edition D&D with rules cleaned up. Like, you always want a high number, because that was one of the big things in first edition D&D. It's like, well, I want a low number for my saving throws and a low number for my AC, and I want a low number for my THACO, but I want to roll high when I do that. And it was just really confusing after a while. So this one, it takes all that, it cleans it up, and the great thing is you can use first and second edition material, like modules and stuff, with pretty minimal work to translate it. And then you can also use all of that D20 material that came out in the big boom with third edition. So I'll be giving you more information on this as I read more into it, but I have the core books of it, and I'm really liking it. So if you want to check it out for yourself, check out trolllord.com. They run a lot of deals on rpgnow.com and PDFs that you can get on demand. So check it out.
Outstanding.
Let me see what else. In general geekery, I've gotten into comics a little bit, and this is kind of a step for me.
Yeah.
A little bit.
You know, you're a consummate geek, but not really a comic book guy.
Not a comic geek.
Yeah. Me neither.
Knights of the Dinner Table was about...
That's about it, huh?
Yeah, but my father and brother-in-law are big into comics, and it's always been one of those things where, you know, I read a couple trades. I read, like, Watchmen, and I read, you know, like, Dark Knight Returns and such, but I never really read monthly comics. So I had them kind of give me a primer on things, and I went to my friendly local comic shop and picked out a few titles. It's been interesting. There's a lot I don't get because, you know, there's all this backstory. Like, I'm a big Superman guy,
yeah,
and there's some of the Superman villains I don't even know. But I picked up a few issues of various titles, and it's interesting. We'll see how it goes.
Now, is it, and you may not know the answer to this because you're just getting into it, but things like Superman, is there still just a Superman comic?
Yes.
Or is it now Superman's Revenge and Superman comes to your town or yeah, whatever, you know?
Yeah. Right now there's just a Superman comic, but
okay.
I think they still do like the action comics that okay. he first came in, and then, you know, I think they do special things. Like, there's one for the Flash now that's called Flashpoint.
Okay.
That's about him, and then it's kind of like an alternate universe thing. But the most interesting one is, I'm only getting a few titles. I don't want to burn myself out here, but one of them is called Batman Incorporated, and it's the idea that Bruce Wayne has basically gone around the world and contracted out and basically like franchised
Batman.
You know, all right. So there's Batman in South America, there's Batman in Europe, and, you know, in all these countries. And
it'd be great if there's like an issue with like the convention, you know. Yeah. Well, I'm the Des Moines Batman.
Des Moines Batman. Don't
do a lot.
The Dayton Batman. But so that's interesting. I'll see how that goes. But
that's cool.
Yeah, well, I trying to round out my geekness. You know, it's something I always wanted to try and finally put a toe in the water there.
Yeah.
And then to round out my geekery, I'm still reading book two of the Song of Ice and Fire. I'm reading Clash of Kings right now, and it's very good. Been watching the TV series. John has HBO, so he hooked me up, and
yep,
we've been watching that. It's a good TV series. I mean, it's...
They pull no punches.
They beheaded a horse last night.
Yeah.
Ooh, that was rough, but definitely good, and the books are phenomenal. Some of the best books I've ever read, so highly recommended. And that's my rundown. That was a lot.
That was a little bit of gaming and a lot of extra geekery there. So yeah,
sorry.
It's all good. Okay, so for me, I went, of course, to the same game night as Cody and played Das Motorsport in Spielen and also World Without End. End of the night, I also got in a game of Unspeakable Words, which I hadn't played in quite a while.
That's
that one's
a
lot of fun. And I love playing that game with the variant where when you get down to your last Cthulhu pawn, you know, you're playing mm-hmm. these cards and forming words. And then based upon what words you form, you might go a little bit insane. When you get to the very last sanity point, more or less, you're allowed to... There's a variant where you're allowed to basically put down whatever letters you want. Like, I'm spelling Schlimmelawawa because I'm going crazy. And then if you're able to make your saving throw on that, then you're able to continue playing the game and score the points for it. So that one's fun. So I enjoyed playing that one. Let's see. Since then, Cody and I, we mentioned on the last show that we've been playing an online game of Through the Ages with Russ Wakeland from the D6 Generation and Jeff Engelstein from various podcasts, The Dice Tower and Ludology and...
Cooking with Jeff Engelstein.
Cooking with Jeff, yeah. But we decided we wanted to get a game of this to the... And I think we've played... Is it two times since the last show? Maybe just one, but...
I think just one.
Okay, but we played again, and this time played the full game... Just sat down on a Saturday afternoon and said, we're going to go from start to finish, play through all the cards, and do the full deal. And man, it is such a good game.
Yeah, I love it.
It is so good, and we it was such a rich experience. It took us a little over 3 hours to get through the entire game, and we know the rules pretty well. I can imagine if you have three players, it would... I don't know, it might not be that much longer. We could still streamline a little bit more, but
yeah, because the one thing is with the last phase where you're doing your scoring, the game recommends that while one person is doing their scoring and adjusting their tracks and everything, that the next player can begin.
Yeah.
We didn't do that just because it was our first full game. We wanted to just make sure that, you know, we had it down. But I think in future games, that'll help streamline it. I can't imagine this game with four, even if everyone knew the rules. I think that would just be way too
real long.
Yeah.
But we played the full game, and I enjoyed it a whole lot, despite the fact that Cody whipped me pretty badly. By over 50 points. I think he got me by more than 50 points. But
culture, folks. I got it.
Well, I it's the military part of the game that I haven't really been able to get a good handle on, because I would much rather play a game that doesn't build up a lot of military. Mm-hmm. I don't care about that so much. You know, in Civilization, the board game, the new Fantasy Flight one, I don't want to go for the military victory. I want to build my little culture track and all that kind of stuff. But you can't really do that in Through the Ages. You have to have at least some military strength, or you will get attacked. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think it's the war card. That was one of the things in the full game that we hadn't played with, is war cards in a two-player game. You declare war on the other player, and then the difference in your strength sometimes will cause you to lose huge amounts of stuff. So I found that when Cody declared war on me, and there was this huge difference between the strength of our civilizations, I had to spend the next turn beefing up what I had just to basically, you know, reduce some of the damage that he was going to inflict. So that was fun.
Yeah, you know, what makes this game great is you can't really afford to completely ignore any one part, whether that be military or the science part, because my biggest problem in the game, like in life really, was science, because it was just like I was not building that part fast enough, and it took me just too long to bring out new techs. But it was the game is just so elegant, and you know, I think I remember when we first reviewed it, you know, we complained about the price, and Scott Nicholson was saying, you know, he emailed or called in and said, you know, it's about the playtesting. And now I'm seeing it. You know, having played an advanced game and a full game, I see just how tight and how elegant this game is. So I think it's definitely going to be making an appearance on both of our top 11 lists when that time of year comes around.
Spoiler.
Oh, so spoiler alert.
So enjoyed that one. We got a copy of a new game, and I can't remember the name of the publisher at this point because I don't have it in front of me, but the game Eliminis.
Yes, Smiley Pop.
Smiley Pop, okay. Mm-hmm. And so thanks so much for that review copy. And I got to play that. It's a little card game that's, I think, geared mainly more towards families and even families with small kids. So I played it with both of my kids. It was just the three of us. My wife was out for the evening. And it was really good. It's basically where you're just trying, you draw a card from the middle and you're trying to get these cards on your display, one of each of these five little Eliminis. They're like rock and earth and fire and earth, wind, and fire and blood, sweat, and tears. I don't know. And, you know, there's things you can do where you draw a card and you can sort of, you know, replace other people's cards and things like that. It's got a little bit of a take that mechanic to it. It's got some Uno sort of mechanics to it where you can change the direction of play and all that kind of stuff. It's very easy to play, but because it has that take that to it, this game caused a lot of crying and whining and pain in my family because my little five-year-old, every time she had an opportunity to do a take that, she didn't pick daddy, she picked her big brother.
Oh, no.
And so big brother got a little bit irritated to the point where he was almost throwing cards. So it was a good teaching moment to be able to, you know, teach about game situations, you know. It was actually kind of funny because I kept saying, you know, Ethan, you know how many games daddy plays on a weekly or monthly basis? And do you know how many of those I win? Not very many. He's like, yeah, Cody wins a lot of games, doesn't he? Like, Yes, well, yes, go to your room.
smart boy.
It's a fun, light little game. I think it's real good for families with small kids. So, Eliminis. Got to head of some friends over for dinner. My wife and I did, and we got a chance to bring Survive to the table. And
well, we're doing the Stronghold.
Trifecta. Wow. Okay. Hey, thanks, Stronghold Games. But yeah, this was a couple that we knew from church that had told us when we sat down and had dinner. They said, you know, we're anxious to play some games with you because we're really big gamers. Now, what they meant by that was that they're really big game players of, you know, mass market games. So you could tell they hadn't really been exposed to the wider world of gaming, even things like Ticket to Ride. But when I showed them my game collection, they were looking in the shelves and everything, and they said, oh, I haven't played any or heard of any of these games. And they seemed real eager. So I thought Survive was a good entry point of one that's more, you know, probably it was a mass market game back, you know, 25 years ago. And, you know, now it's, you know, been reproduced. And I thought that would be kind of a good light one to start with. And they really liked it, I think. It wasn't as raucous or take that as I've played it before. It was a little bit more subdued, but I think they had a good time playing it. It's a fun one.
You know, Stronghold now, they've got Survive, Code 77, and then Confusion coming out this summer.
Yes.
That's their three that they'll have out by the summer, correct?
I believe so, yes.
They're 3 for 3, not to completely spoil things.
Yeah.
They're 3 for 3 right now.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing that out there. They've been very impressive so far.
Yeah, that you can't deny it.
So just throwing that out there.
So, enjoyed that one, that game. Mentioned we did play Confusion, which we'll talk about in just a little bit, and Twilight Struggle. Played Triumvirate a couple of times. Played with Cody. Also played with my buddy Pete at work.
Action Pete.
And that's a great one. We've talked about that on the show before. A great two-player trick-taking game. The more I play that one, the more I start to understand the strategy a little bit better, you know, because that it's so strange having this two-player trick-taking thing where you want certain colors to win the round, but not always. Like you may go into a round aiming for a color that you don't want to win to actually win, because you've got to do that sort of, you can't always be going for the win or you just won't get it. Mm-hmm. So that's a very different sort of aspect of the game, which I think is a lot of fun. The only other thing that I've really been playing a good bit of is on the video game front. I've finally finished the single player campaign for Portal 2.
Mm.
And boy, I got to tell you, I don't play a lot of video games, so I'm not probably the best. Don't take this with a grain of salt. It's the best video game I've ever played. But I mean, I don't play a lot of video games, so you know, I'm not really into first person shooters. I do love puzzle games. I don't like games where stuff jumps out at me. Mm-hmm. I hate that sort of tension. So the nice thing about Portal 2 and the original Portal as well is that you have time to sort of figure the puzzle out, and with the exception of just a couple of things, you have plenty of time to work it out. But great story, you know, great. I gushed about it last time. It's a lot of fun. And go ahead.
I was going to say we played co-op, and
yeah,
that was a lot of fun.
It is, yeah. So they've designed that real well to where you can you sort of have to work together, and each of you builds portals to make things happen. And we may try that one if you pick it up at some point. We might try that one online. We actually did the split screen, so that one's a great one. Go check that one out.
Yeah, and I have one more thing to add on video game news. I have not pre-ordered a game in a very, very long time, like since I probably had high school, maybe college. I pre-ordered L.A. Noire because I saw the commercials. I love that kind of, you know, like that film noir style thing, the pulp crime sort of thing. And it's gotten really good reviews so far, and it comes out officially tomorrow. Ooh. So I'll let you know about that. Video game on.
I'll swap you Portal 2 for L.A. Noire when you get done with it.
We might have a deal there.
Outstanding. Okay, and so just want to mention just a couple of other things, sort of finish the games that we've been talking about. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Jones Theory.
I'm always here to educate. Yes.
Okay. So the Jones Theory, we've mentioned on countless episodes, it's become kind of a benchmark for our show, is this idea that Cody came up with, revolutionary that he is,
yeah,
of game collecting.
Now that one guy that always posts on the guilds, like, oh, I've been following it for 27 years. Like, I know it's okay, not a new idea.
It's a joke. We know it's not a new idea. But Cody kind of brought forth this idea and perpetuated that, you know, you should only have in your collection one game of any particular type, either based upon theme or mechanic. You know, you need to have buckets, if you will, and only one game per bucket in your collection.
With the overarching theme that the idea is to get the games to the table.
Yes, the whole purpose of it is that you get the games to the table, that you don't have games sitting in your collection, gathering dust, and not getting to the table.
So you can have a big collection if you get the games to the table. Exactly. I just have to put that disclaimer in there.
Because you end up with like a lot of commentary on the Dune theory has been about, you know, well, what about this situation? What about that situation?
So I can't have seven wonders through the ages? Yeah, so you're saying I can't have...
Yeah. No. So I want to present, I'm becoming more and more of a proponent of the Jones theory, but I want to present a slightly different idea, and I have no good name for it. We could call it the Richard theory or the John theory.
Now, one of the threads that have popped up around BGG says I should call it the Jones method. But it's the Jones theory already. We can't change
trademark.
<that.
laughs>
But you have a clean slate, my friend.
Maybe the Richard method, yeah.
The Richard method.
The method de Richard, yeah. So my idea about game collecting, and really I've only come up with this because it's sort of it validates my own personal gaming collecting habits, is that, well, let me back up. In my house, I have a big, in my garage, I have a big Rubbermaid tub, you know, with a lid on it that's, it's about 2 feet by 2 feet and, you know, 2 feet deep, kind of a big cube thing. And in that tub, I've had it for years, I have all of my, what I call sentimental stuff. So, you know, I went to the Billy Joel and Elton John concert in 1993, you know, and I have the program from that concert, you know.
I was 10.
Thank you.
Just throwing that out there.
Okay. And so I have the Mickey Mouse ears that I got when I went to Disneyland in 1999. And I just all these things that I've collected are all my fraternity stuff from college, you know, these things that are important to me and that generate memories and that kind of stuff are all in this tub. And the idea that I've always had is that that is the space that I've allocated for my sentimental stuff. And if I ever fill that up, and it's about 3/4 full at this point, but if I ever fill it up and then have another thing that I want to put into that bucket, then I have to take something out. And I'll dig through it and maybe find that thing of, oh, I don't really care so much about this picture that I took when I went skiing 25 years ago or whatever. So, you know, but I have to make room because that is the space that I have allocated for this kind of stuff. So when it comes to gaming, this is the theory or the method that I would present to you, is the idea that you have a designated amount of space in your house. Again, this is not a new theory either. So I know if you guys are sitting there listening saying, well, this is a no-brainer. Well, yes, it is, you know, but
they're ready at their keyboards.
I know, right? I was going to say that's Cody, but you don't have your own. if they send a bad email, it comes to me too. So anyway, the idea would be that you have a designated space in your house and you can determine, much like the buckets and the Jones theory idea, you can determine how much space that is. Is it one bookshelf? Is it a drawer? Is it an entire room? Is it three rooms? Is it a floor? Is it your whole garage? You know, whatever. But you designate that space and then you fill that space with your games, you know, and it could be things you play all the time, things you hope to play. You know, I would still hope that you're not going to put things on there that you just want to sit and stare at, you know, get games to the table, but that you limit the amount of space that you have. And once that space is full, then if you want to put something else in and buy something else, then something else has to go. This is not a revolutionary concept, but I think for me, it makes more sense to me than the Jones theory, because I do have those games that that multiple games for a particular theme or genre, and maybe they would only come out every fourth or fifth time that particular bucket would be brought up, you know, like cooperative with No Trader, you know. Maybe I have three games that I would want to play in that category, and one of them would come up more often than others, but the others would eventually, you know. I want to keep those in my collection. I don't want to be limited to just having the one thing. Because that one situation will come up and I'll say, man, I wish I did have a copy of Pandemic. That is a pretty good game. You know, and I'd rather just go ahead and have it on hand. So that's the idea that I have, is that in my house I currently have 4 bookshelves.
Jeez.
That, easy now.
Sorry.
I have 4 bookshelves in one room, and they are not quite full right now. And so I have some space to breathe here. But if I ever get to the point where it's full, then I need to start trading in games or selling them or whatever. So I present that to you listeners as an alternative to the Jones theory, or, you know, depending on your space situation, you could combine the ideas together. But tell me what you think about that. And what do you think about that, Cody?
Here's my questions.
Go ahead.
Do you, I mean, and I'm going to be really legalistic about this.
I know, because you're a jerk.
No, no, I mean, so many games have really bad boxes, you know, boxes that are too big. You know, they don't need to be that big. Do you keep them in, do you have to keep them in the original box? Or what if you take a bunch of them down to, like, smaller boxes that are, like, half the size?
See, now you're starting to sound like the people of the guild.
No, no, I'm just being...
Oh, so you're saying I can't keep my Rune Wars box? Is that what you're telling me?
I'm saying, what if you take an old FFG coffin box and fill it with a bunch of, like, little card games or something?
That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine.
I'm just curious.
However, if you want to rebox your games, I personally like the boxes that my games come in. I don't like to, you know, rip things apart and put them in different containers. But whatever, you know, I'm just saying that whatever square footage or square inches or whatever square miles that you... will designate as your gaming space, that you just keep to that and that you, you know, fill it up, you know. But once it gets past that fill up point, you're done. You're done. Mm. So there you go. Okay. You got nothing?
Hey, it's cute, you know.
Oh, please. Oh, yeah. So one more thing I wanted to talk about is Origins is coming in about...
Winter's coming.
Origins is coming in about a month and a half. And I will be at Origins this year. And we got an email from our good buddy Tyler, who is... Trevlix is his Board Game Geek user name. But he is sort of the grand poobah who runs the giant Origins math trade every year. And I participated in this last year. I want to say I had like 7 or 8 or 9 games that
you traded. Had a pretty good haul, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And came back with some great stuff. But Tyler runs this thing very, very well. And he sent us an email just to remind us about the Origins math trade, that it's going to be starting up. I think the very beginning of June is when the geek list will start to fill up with games for trade. And for those of you who aren't familiar with math trades, just go on Board Game Geek and search for math trades, and you can get a full idea of how that works.
And this is the best kind of math trade to get into, because it's no ship.
Exactly. Yep. So a lot of math trades is basically you put up the games that you want to trade for. Other people will do the same. You go through this computer algorithm that matches you up. And then you'll ship the game out to the person that you want, and they'll ship you, and someone else will ship you their game, and it's really cool. But the great part, like Cody said, about a no ship math trade is that you'll just do the math trade, and then you'll just take your games to Origins, and there'll be a particular designated time and space at the convention center to meet up and basically trade your games. And it only takes, if everybody shows up on time, which isn't always the case, but, you know, it only takes about 15, 20 minutes, you know, or more, maybe half an hour, to make sure that you get all of your stuff. So it's a lot of fun. And if you have games in your collection that don't fit either the Jones Theory or the Richard Method, I got to come up with a name for it, then please put them in the Origins math trade and bring them. And, you know, you can trade away for some games that would get to your table even more often. So Tyler, thanks so much for emailing us about that, and we'll put a link to the math trade information and the Origins math trade in the show notes.
Indeed. In Soviet Russia, game plays you.
Oh. Nice.
That's the first time, but not the last time that joke's
going to
be used.
I'm sure that joke will come out at least a couple more times.
You know, so we're going to be talking about Cold War games. And like John said earlier, it's not a genre you would consider many games to have that theme. But we've got three very different games that we're going to talk about that share that theme. And, about the theme itself. Tell us a little bit about it.
So, I mean, the Cold War is just sort of the name given to this period of time. And I'm by no means a history expert, so, you know, take all of this as a grain of salt. This sort of area of history sort of between, I guess, World War II and the early 90s, you know, sort of with the fall of the Berlin Wall and that kind of stuff, the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it's this sort of tense time where you had sort of democracy in the United States, and the communism of the Soviet Union, and this tension that existed for just decades and decades, and this sort of fear, and uncertainty that existed as these two great superpowers sort of battled, but it wasn't a battle that was really fought with any guns.
Right.
And you know, like the fact that it's called a war at all is sort of interesting that it's been pegged that way historically, because there's nuclear arms involved. no nuclear arms were ever fired. You know, there was this buildup of this kind of, you know, this nuclear proliferation and, you know, and a lot of real sort of bad feelings that were generated, and a lot of close calls where really bad stuff could have happened. But
Cuban Missile Crisis
as a good example, yes. But you know, and so it makes for a very interesting theme, I guess, for especially for gaming. Now, I grew up, I was born in the mid to late 70s, and so I was a kid in the 80s and in the early 90s, and sort of grew up with this idea of the Cold War and the Soviet Union kind of being like the bad guys, you know. I mean, you're a little younger than I am. Did you have any memories of that? Or
the only thing that I remember from that time specifically is I remember I didn't understand why my mom made such a big deal about the Soviet Union collapsing. Like, she saved the newspaper and she's going on about it. I just didn't get it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, through watching great films like Rocky IV, I really got the full breadth and depth of the Cold War and how it affected us, and how Rocky Balboa brought the United States and the Soviet Union together on Christmas in Moscow after beating Ivan Drago in a 15-round fight.
You know, I know you say that sort of tongue-in-cheek, but that is absolutely almost kind of a quintessential Cold War movie. You know, I'm not even really joking, you know, because you really did have this sort of, you know, it was America versus the Soviet Union, you know, and they really painted Ivan Drago, you know.
Is it East versus West? Or man against man?
Okay. Right.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
If he dies, he dies.
Yeah. I must break you. So it was a real sort of tense time. And so it makes for just some very interesting gameplay for games, because all the games that we're talking about, that we're going to be talking about today, have this sort of aspect of war and of conflict, but there's not really much in the way of military in these games.
A lot of subterfuge. A lot of subterfuge. Espionage.
Yeah, a lot of misdirection, a lot of misunderstanding, you know, and a lot of sitting across the table and kind of staring the other person down and saying, you know, what are you going to do, you know? Because that really sort of highlighted what was going on between the Soviet Union and the United States during these times. So we have three games that we're going to talk about, and they are all two-player games, which I thought was very interesting, which kind of makes sense because you have the struggle between those two nations and you have struggle between two players. And one game is sort of a lighter card game that's based on really sort of a blackjack mechanic. Twilight Struggle is a big sort of you know, it's actually been called a war game by some people, but it's a very big battle for influence and battle for, it's a victory point sort of a game. And then you have Confusion, which is a deduction style game that's lumped in with sort of a chess style abstract strategy game. So let's go ahead and just get started with the first game, and that is Cold War CIA versus KGB. All right, so Cold War CIA versus KGB is a two-player card game designed by David Rakoto and Sebastian Gigodo, I think that's how you pronounce that, and was published by Fantasy Flight Games. It came out just two or three years ago. And the idea of this game is that you have a deck of cards that you're going to be taking turns drawing a card and then deciding what you want to do with it. And each round, when one player's playing KGB, one's playing CIA, you're trying to take hold of a particular country. It's called an objective card. And the objective card will specifically say what some of the limitations are of that particular round. A player gets like a set of operative cards where you have like the director and the deputy director.
The Agent X's,
yeah. And the assassin and that kind of stuff, the master spy. And, you know, you're going to choose one of these spies or operatives to go on a mission, agent, that's the word, and you're going to put that face down. Then you're going to have this card in front of you that's going to tell you what you're fighting for. It's going to tell you how many cards you can have in front of you, and that's called the stability number, I believe.
Yes.
And then you also have like a number that you're trying to hit.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. The number of cards you can have is the population, and then the big number that you're trying to, basically the 21. To put it in blackjack terms, that's your stability number.
Right, okay. And so then you're going to take turns drawing cards out of this group deck. And there's different colors of cards, And there's really, I mean, there's not a lot of, each color does a certain thing, but mm-hmm. I think there's like four colors in the game, and that's about it.
Yeah, so. And they're, and the cards are, the theme's kind of loose here because they're considered to be different groups. So like one of them may be...
like mafia, you know, everyone says mafia.
Yeah, but basically there are four groups, like there's like media, military, political, and like... economic or
businesses and that kind of stuff.
And they may all have different names and pictures, but basically they all do, all of the military cards do one thing, all of the political cards do one thing.
Exactly. And so each card has a number on it. And so when you draw the card, you basically have to play it in front of you. And so, you know, you'll play that card in front of you and it'll have a number on it. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to get to that stability number without going over and without playing more cards than your population allowance there. So you'll draw a card and play it. Your opponent will draw a card and play it. And then you always have the opportunity to either draw a card and play it, or you can use one of the abilities of one of the cards that's in front of you. And to do that, you'll turn it to the side or...
You will mobilize it.
Mobilize it. You won't tap it.
You certainly would not tap it.
Of course you wouldn't tap it.
Nor would you kneel it, nor would you...
Nor would you exhaust it.
Exhaust it.
Yeah, yes, yeah. You'll mobilize it by turning it to the side. Yeah. And that will cause you to do certain things. So, and they all do the same. The different colors do the same things. The green cards will allow you to basically discard another player's group, one of their groups. The yellow cards, like the economic cards, will allow you to mobilize any ready group, which is the untapped word, mm-hmm. or ready any mobilized group. So you can tap and untap things. The government cards will allow you to steal a group from your opponent or give him one of yours. And then the media card will allow you to look at the top deck of the group deck, and then you can either put it in front of you, or you can discard it, or you can leave it where it is. So just having those four options gives you a lot of flexibility in this game. And it's sort of this game of chicken, mm-hmm. because you're going to lay down your cards, and then at some point you're going to say pass. You know, it's like if the stability number is a 9 and you have an 8, and you think that's good enough to beat your opponent, then you can say pass. And, you know, the opponent can do what they want. And they might be able to do things that will steal cards from you or to remove cards and that kind of stuff. And you're going to go back and forth and have this sort of push, pull, and tension until you get to a point where both players pass. And then you'll see who was the winner of the contest there. Now, the funny thing is that you have one card in your deck called the Master Spy, which will basically, it sort of reverses things where if you were the loser, then it actually means that you would win that group. And so you never know when that card's being played, which makes it, you know, again, this game, like the other two we're going to talk about, has a lot of these moments of sort of squinting your eyes at your opponent and going, what exactly are you doing over there? Mm-hmm. And so that's the basics of the game, is that each of these, the objective cards is going to be worth a certain number of points, which you'll tally up on your card, and then you'll play to like 100 points, and whoever's has the many points is the winner. And I think this is a really great two-player game because of like the back and forth tension that exists for it. And you know, so Cody, what do you think of KGB versus CIA Cold War?
This one's really nice because I really appreciate games where the depth of the game is not apparent on the first play. Because uh-huh. like the first time I played it, I'm like, oh, this is just kind of like trumped up blackjack. And then you really start to see once you mix in all of the different groups' powers and you have the different Agent X's that you can use. And it's just, for what you get in the game, it's such a deep and rich two-player game. It's a steal for what you get. I mean, it's one of the best Silver Line games out there. And the theme, even though, you know, like with the groups, it's a little pasted on, but it, like John said, it really captures that feel of misdirection, and you're trying to, you know, you want to outthink your opponent, but you don't want to overthink it. And there's just a lot going on, and it's just a great two-player game. Plays in about 30 to 45 minutes, I'd say.
Yeah.
All said and done.
And that's my favorite part about it, is that sort of misdirection thing. The idea that if you know, looking at the numbers, that you're going to win, and you pass, and then your opponent passes, it's like, you know, then you ask the question, did you play the Master Spy? And you turn it over, and you go, oh, crap, you played the Master Spy. And I love that's aspect of the game. It's a real deceiving one. I think it kind of flies under the radar. I don't think it's on anybody's top 10 of all time list, you know, but it is an absolutely solid game, and it's easy to teach to people who aren't gamers, I think, because of the theme. Because I think anybody who's oh, I don't know. How old are you? 28? Anyone who's 28 or older, I think would have a stake in this, in the Cold War idea. And the fact that it's based upon a blackjack mechanic, I think it makes it real accessible. There's some other little fiddly bits and pieces about the game, especially the powers of the different agents.
Mm-hmm.
That might take a little bit of getting used to about what exactly those mean. But overall, I think it's just a really, really good game. So there's our first game, Cold War CIA versus KGB. I was born.
Our second game is much different than Cold War, a CIA versus KGB, but still manages to hold that kind of struggle, you might say?
I would say.
A Twilight struggle, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
This is currently the number one game on BoardGameGeek, gets a lot of press, is the predecessor of one of your favorite games, 1960, The Making of the President.
That's right.
And this is... it's just a big old meaty game,
yeah,
and it is.
That's the best way to describe it. Yeah,
it's a big old meaty game. It's not the prettiest game out there, but it does.
It does what it needs to do.
It does what it needs to do, and that's a Twilight Struggle from GMT Games.
Right. So Twilight Struggle was designed back about 4 or 5 years ago by Jason Matthews and Ananda Gupta, produced by GMT Games. And the first versions that came out had kind of that GMT production to it, you know.
I.e. not very good.
Well, you know, they definitely focus on the mechanics and the game design and not so much on the components. So your board was this sort of folded cardboard, just cardstock board. In 2009, they came out with the Deluxe Edition, which is the version that I have, which has a fully mounted board. And you know, some nice cardboard pieces to it. It's still not like the Fantasy Flight style deal where you've got miniatures and all this kind of stuff. But you know, the card quality is really good. Everything's very clear. You know, you are using kind of cardboard counters on the board, but I think it's serviceable, and I think the overall artwork on the board, I think, looks pretty cool. You know,
I think it does its job. It's like I've seen earlier editions of this game with the unmounted board,
yeah,
where it's just this fold out and it's just heavy card stock. I'm like, really? Man, because it is a good game, but just to see it kind of crippled by that bad design and that bad packaging.
I have to think that. Making the deluxe edition has helped the stock of this game to rise. So.
It's got to. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But you know, so the idea is much like the other things we've been talking about, is that this is a game that simulates some of the stuff that happened during the Cold War, and you sort of play out from beginning to end the events of the early, middle, and sort of late war, leading up to, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union towards the end of the 80s. The term Twilight Struggle actually comes from the inauguration speech of John F. Kennedy, President of the United States, from 1961 to 1963. And this was the quote where that came from. "Now the trumpets summon us again, not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need, not as a call to battle, though embattled we are, but a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle."
Say chowda.
Chowda.
Showda.
That was said with the utmost respect. I don't have a very good Massachusetts accent.
Ask not
what your country... Anyway, so yeah, that was what he said there. And so, you know, like he says in the quote there, you know, it's not a call to bear arms, the arms we need. You know, big buildup of forces. And, you know, this game highlights things like the space race, where you start with like Sputnik and the making it to the moon and that kind of stuff. And we were in this sort of race with the Soviet Union for that entire time. And so this game, you know, plays this out in much in the way the game 1960, which is, you know, a later game, plays out the events of the 1960 presidential election. And the idea is that, you know, one player plays the United States, the other one plays the Soviet Union, and you're trying to gain influence in different areas around the world. And so you have these tokens that represent influence and influence points that you're placing onto the board. And so on your turn, the game is very card driven, and so you're going to get a hand of cards every round. And then you're going to go back and forth during this action round playing cards. And the cards are either going to be for... you're either going to play them for points or you're going to play them for the event that's on the card. And, you know, these points that you have, they're called operations points. Each card is going to have a certain number of those. And if you decide to use them for operations points, then you're going to be able to choose from a few different actions that you're going to do. And you know, the idea is you're placing this influence on the board. You're trying to swing things in your direction so that at certain points in the game, scoring cards are going to be played. And then based upon how much influence you have and where you have that influence placed, you're going to get certain amount of victory points. Much in the same theme of this idea of a struggle, the victory points are on sort of a tight rod, like a tug of war rope sort of a track. So if I gain, you start off the game at 0 points, right? So if I gain 5 points, and then Cody on his turn, he gains 3 points, then there's only one scoring marker. So it basically would just come back 3 points to three points to where I now have 2 points. And so there's always this kind of back and forth of when you're gaining points, you're actually taking them away from your opponent if they're in the lead. And so that's a very interesting aspect of the game as well. So when you play these cards, they're either going to have an event on them, and the event will either benefit you, your opponent, or it could be just sort of a generic event that might benefit either player, depending on the situations in the game. And so if you play for the event, then you'll just do whatever the event says and just carry that out that action. If you play a card for the points, then the event may or may not also happen. So if I'm the Soviet Union player and I play a card for the operations points, but it includes an event that would be for the United States, then that event still triggers. I get to choose whether it triggers before or after I take my turn, but it will still trigger. And so that, you know, when you're looking at your cards in your hand, you have to sort of figure out what order you want to play certain things. And the text on the card is really what drives this game. And that's where the sort of the play testing, I think, and a lot of the meat of the game is how these cards interact with one another and the different actions. So if you decide to use operations points, what you basically can do are one of a few different things here. You can place influence markers. So you can place increase the influence in a country by placing markers, one marker per operations point. So that's pretty easy to do that. You can do things called realignment rolls. And this is where the game actually does come with two dice. And so that's exciting. You know, dice are fun. And this is where you can reduce the enemy influence that's in a country. Each player is going to roll a die and then add some modifiers based upon how much influence they have in adjacent countries and things like that. And then depending on what the difference is in those amounts, you're going to remove influence. If you win, then you're going to remove influence that's equal to the difference between your roles. So this is a good way if you are trying to fight for a particular country that you can reduce the influence in that particular country. But it's sort of a pseudo peaceful way of doing it. That's why it's called realignment. Another thing that you can use your operations points for is to do military coups. And this will reduce influence in a country and possibly add influence to that country for your own superpower. So whereas the realignment roles, you can reduce influence of someone else, but you're not going to actually gain any influence. In this game, in the coups, that's where you possibly could. So this is more like an actual military battle. And so you're going to play the card for those points, and you're going to take the stability number of the target country. I know I'm throwing out a lot of terms here, but on the board in each country, there's like a little number called a stability number. You're going to multiply that number by 2, roll your die, and then add the operations points on the card that you're playing. So the die roll plus the operations points, and if that die roll is greater than this doubled stability number, then your coup is successful. That seems like a lot of math and a lot of, it's really not that difficult at all. Once you sort of sit down and look at it, it's just basically a die roll with a modifier that's compared against a doubled stability number of the country. And so if you have a successful coup, you're going to remove your some influence from the target country of your opponent. And then you could possibly place some of your own influence. If you're unsuccessful, then nothing is removed and so forth. So you have, you can place influence directly. You can do realignment roles, which is more like a peaceful influence reduction. And then you have the coups, which is going to be a little more serious. And also during your turn, you're required to perform a certain number of military operations. And so coups will count as military operations. If you don't complete a certain number of those by the end of your round, then you're going to have some consequences of that. And there's even like a DEFCON track that's going to move around. And you know, with one of the end conditions of the game being that if you ever get like to DEFCON 1 or whatever the lowest one is,
DEFCON 1,
yeah, which is like nuclear, imminent nuclear war, then you know, if you've caused that to happen, then your opponent wins the game.
So, I thought the military operations track was a nice touch because you know, in this game you could play just entirely defensive, and this forces you. You have to make a few aggressive actions per turn or suffer the consequences. So I like that it kind of, it, you know, both with affecting stability of countries and kind of meddling with your opponent's forces, this was that nice touch of that kind of underlying military threat of that age, you know,
right.
Where it's like, well, you know, it's you really feel like you have to do the certain amount of military things. So that was a nice touch.
Yeah. You also have things like the space race where you can spend your points to try to move up on the space race. That'll get you victory points and additional abilities as you move closer, you know, farther down the track. It's all very themey in that it sort of plays out some of the events that happened in the actual space race in history. But, you know, that's just sort of the general idea, is that you're trying to gain more influence in these different countries with the idea that there's certain cards that are going to come out that are scoring cards. And the way the scoring will work in the game is that you have what's called one of three different things. You have presence, domination, or control in a particular region. And so presence just means that you control one or more countries in a region. And control is just defined as you have you have more influence than your opponent, and that the amount that you have that's more than your opponent is greater than the stability number in the country. Again, that sounds confusing, but basically it means that if you had a country with a stability number of 2, then you would need to have at least 2 influence in there, and you'd have to have at least 2 more than your opponent. So if you had 4 and your opponent had 3, you wouldn't have control. But if you had 4 and your opponent had 2, then you would have control. So that's basically just how that works. So if you have control of one or more countries in a region, then you're said to have presence. If you control more countries and more battleground countries, these are countries that just have a particular marking on them, in the region than your opponent, and you control at least one battleground and one non-battleground state, then you're considered to have domination. That gets you even more points. And then you have what's called control, that's where you control more countries and all the battleground countries that are in a region. And so those are the three main scoring conditions. So when the scoring cards come up, you're going to count up all that stuff and you'll get points based upon that. You know, so the game will continue for 10 rounds. And, you know, as you go back and
forth. So there are several ways to win in this game or to end the game.
And there are several automatic victory conditions. And so if one player reaches 20 victory points, then that's an automatic win. Also, if either side controls Europe when a Europe scoring card is played, then they win. That's real hard.
Yeah.
But because that's going to be one of the main places where you're going back and forth.
Yeah, I thought that's the route I was going to go when we played. I'm like, no, this isn't going to work.
It's not going to happen. And then, like as I mentioned before, the nuclear war thing, if an opponent causes the DEFCON level to reach 1, then you win the game. But if none of those things happen, then you have an end game victory where after 10 rounds, every region is scored as if you had played a scoring card in that region. And then you're going to calculate your score and see who the winner is there. So, you know, it may seem like I've kind of gone over a lot of sort of picky rules. There really aren't that many things you can do in this game. It's just knowing, you know, which bonuses to apply and what to roll and that kind of stuff. There's some really great reference cards that come with the game that explain all of those, the realignment rolls and the coups and that kind of stuff. Everything else is really dictated by the text on the card. And I also want to mention that on these cards, each card represents a person or an event that happened in the real Cold War. And so the history that's sort of woven into this game is really, really cool because you sort of see, you know, how as the cards progress, you see as, you know, things get later on in history, you get to learn quite a bit about what really went on.
Yeah, this game does a really good job of not only mixing the history element, but it's a great example of one of those games that isn't particularly difficult to learn, but is complex. There's a lot going on,
yes.
And there's a lot of strategy, but it doesn't take a whole lot to pick it up. I think after one play of it, you have enough to where you can really start building some strategy. So
right.
I really like those games as well, where it's, you know, it's you know, it's kind of like how I described Twilight Imperium was there's a lot going on. It's complex, but it's not necessarily that difficult.
Yeah. This is one that I think will take you a good 2 to 3 hours to play.
Definitely.
If you know the rules real well. If you know the rules real well and you play real fast, maybe 2 hours, probably closer to 3 hours if you're still learning.
Well
some
into
stuff.
The twilight.
Right. But I think this one's really good. I'm, you know, as I've mentioned in previous top 11s, 1960, The Making of the President is my number 2 game currently. And so I was real interested in trying this one because I wanted to see how it compared. And the jury's still out for me. I need to play it a couple of more times to play Twilight Struggle. For me, the theme of 1960 still rings more true with me because I love American presidential history. But I think that the mechanics and the simplicity of Twilight Struggle, the simple complexity, if you will, like you just mentioned, Cody, that what you're able to do is not that simple, not that difficult, but it is complex.
This game seems tighter than 1960 to me.
Yeah, yeah,
definitely.
Yep, and I think that it's more difficult to know. Well, I won't say that. I was going to say it's more difficult to know whether you're winning or not, but. Because in 1960, you don't really find out until the very end when you do the final tally who won. Here, you might have a bit of more of an idea, but I don't think that there's not going to be a runaway winner unless they get to that 20 victory points.
Yeah.
And from what I've read, I hear that it's not necessarily a balanced game. That it actually is weighted more towards, I don't even remember which player at this point. it's weighted towards one of the countries. It might be the U.S., but. You know, that's okay, I think, you know, if you know that going into it. But I think it's a really good game. I understand why it's rated number one. It probably isn't my number one game, but I give it a real big thumbs up. I think it's a really good one and one to check out. You think, what was your opinion?
Yeah, really great game. This is one I'd like to get to the table more and a deserving number one, at least on the Geek.
Yeah. Okay, so that's Twilight Struggle.
Now the trumpet summons us again. Not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need. Not as a call to battle, though in battle we are. But a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, year in and year out, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, a struggle against the common enemies of man.
All right, so we've done Cold War, KGB versus CIA, Twilight Struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And these are games that have been out for a while. But now.
Mm-hmm. The new hotness.
We bring you the hotness.
The hotness, right? That is not even known yet.
Right? As far as we know, there's only like just a few copies of this game in existence right now, which is very, very exciting.
Exactly.
So once again, I want to pay a little tribute to Jeremy Salinas. We appreciate him ponying up the game for us, letting us borrow it. He got a copy that he did a great video on. And so he let us borrow his copy of it. So this is a great honor to do a review of this game so early.
Mm-hmm.
Did I pour it on thick enough?
A little bit.
Anyway, thanks a lot, Jeremy. So, Confusion, Espionage, and Deception in the Cold War. This is a game that was originally designed by Robert Abbott, who is, I believe, also the designer of Code 777.
I believe so.
Yeah. And so this is, and I hesitate to say it, it's an abstract strategy game.
Yeah, it really is.
I hate abstract strategy
you
games.
You do, by rule.
Well, we'll see. And the theme of the Cold War permeates this game as well. In this game, you're sort of playing a set of spies, or I guess you're maybe playing a leader of a spy network, and you're trying to take your spies, and in the center of the board, you have a top-secret briefcase, and you're in a chess-like sort of fashion. You're trying to take your pieces, gain control of the briefcase, and carry it all the way across the board to the first row of your opponent's side of the board. If you can do that, then you win. Just that simple. But not so simple, because here's the little twist in this game, is that the movement capabilities of your pieces are hidden from you. But the movement capabilities of your opponent's pieces are not hidden from you. So you can see what your opponents can do, but you can't see what your own guys can do. And I'm not sure how the theme exactly fits that, except maybe like they're in country, and so you're not exactly sure what they're doing. Or
yeah. the theme does not permeate the game,
no,
so to speak.
It,
but it's good enough.
I yeah, think. it's well.
I would not say it's pasted on.
No. But you're right. There's some slight inconsistencies right there. But so anyway, the components themselves are these very interesting two-piece I guess they're like Bakelite, is what they call it, that sort of hard, sort of molded plastic sort of stuff, you know, real thick, clinky sort of pieces, kind of like the game Hive. I don't know if you ever played that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's got those clinky pieces. And it's like a rectangle that's sort of hollowed out, and then there's a smaller little rectangular piece that fits inside of it. And this is where sort of the random element comes from. Each of the pieces has a letter designation. And then on the other side is this hole that you will put the movement piece into. And these are all random. And so, you know, piece letter C will not do the same thing as piece letter C does in another game. So the way the game starts off is you're going to take your opponent's pieces and you're going to put all of the little movement pieces in there randomly. And then you're going to set them up in a manner so that your opponent cannot see the back of them. And so that's the way it starts out. In the game, you have this, the way you're going to keep track of things is you have a fold-out cardboard folio, I guess, if you will, that lists all the possible movements. Now, this is all done without text at all. It's just a series of arrows. And so as you're looking at the board, you know, you have the up, down, left, right, diagonals, and that kind of thing. And then a number of maximum number of spaces that you can move. So on the movement piece, it might, you know, have a cross for up and down, left and right, and then a two saying you can go up to two spaces in any of those directions. And so you have a list on this little notebook of all of the possible movements, and then a list of all of the pieces. And it's two-sided, so you have a set for your pieces and your opponent's pieces. So when you set up your opponent's pieces, what I did, I don't know what you did, Cody, but I went and just circled all of the movement capabilities of each of those pieces. Mm-hmm. You can see them on the board, but some of them are kind of, you know, behind each other, and so it's easier to just look in the notebook. So then the game's going to begin, and the way you just take turns, and what you'll do is you'll select a piece, and you'll say, oh, Cody, I'm piece K here. I'd like to move that one two spaces forward. And then Cody will look and see if that's one of the capabilities of that piece, and then he'll just say yes or no. And that's basically how the game works.
Yeah. Now, I kind of want to go back to the folio that you're going to have to mark to do your deduction. This is really nice. I mean, this is the game comes with kind of like a little marker and eraser, you know, dry erase, and it's this kind of almost this laminate feel to it, and it's this really high quality piece. I mean, that's the first thing when I saw other people playing it, was that took me back. I'm like, wow, that is that's pretty slick. So they have not skimped on the component side. It's
it even has like a little strip of foam down one side of it. So when you close it, it's, you know, it
won't erase everything.
It won't erase everything. So that's pretty cool too, or get everything smeared. So you're going to take turns, kind of slowly learning the capability of your pieces. So if I say I want to move forward two spaces and Cody says no, well then for that piece on my little notebook here, I can cross out all of the movements that would include a movement forward of two. So you're going to slowly, by getting these no answers, deduce what your pieces are able to do. And then once you're able to do that, then you're going to try to go after this little briefcase in the middle. Once you sit on top of it, once your piece ends its movement on top of it, then you can carry it with you. And much like chess or checkers, if you end a turn in a space with an opponent's piece, the opponent's piece is moved off the board. There's a couple other little wrinkles in the game that are interesting. There are certain pieces that have a little crown symbol on them that are said to be promotable. And this is much like if you think about, you know, getting kinged in
checkers.
In checkers, yeah. Where you get to the end of the board, if you can get a piece all the way to the end and it's one of the promotable pieces, then you will promote that piece. And you'll take the little movement piece that's in there and turn it around. And all the pieces look the same on the back of them. And they have basically the capability to move up, down, left, right, or diagonally any direction. So much like a king in checkers, you can move them around a lot more with a lot more versatility. So that those pieces can be promoted. Also, there is one piece in the game called the double agent. And this adds even more confusion to the game. In that the double agent is supposed to be kind of working for your opponent. So if I select piece K, and it turns out that piece K is the double agent, and I say, Cody, may I move that forward two spaces? Cody gets to decide whether he's going to say yes or no to that. He can say yes, he can say no, he can say whatever he wants. He can even say yes one turn to that movement, and to the identical movement on a later turn, he can say no. Of course, if he does that, then you pretty much would know that he's the double agent. But that can just really create some misdirection and confusion on that. Yeah. You got it. Yep. Of that piece, because you're not sure exactly what it's doing. And so to mitigate that, on your turn, one of the things that you can do in addition to your normal movement is you can choose to attempt to eliminate the double agent. What you're going to do is just select one of your own pieces and say, I'm removing this one from the board. And, you know, that's your opponent can't do anything about that. And, you know, so you'll remove that piece from the board, but you don't get to find out whether that was the double agent or not. And so, you know, you're still kind of left in the dark there. So you only want to do that if you're pretty sure that that's actually the double agent. You can also choose to eliminate your opponent's double agent. So if you wanted to pick that piece up off the board and then show it to your opponent saying that was your double agent and then get rid of it, then you might be able to do that as well. Beyond that, that is the entire game. Mm-hmm. It's just trying to get that briefcase and take it across the board. And I think Cody, I have rambled on way too much this episode anyway. Tell me what you thought about Confusion.
First off, the components were gorgeous. You know, I want to mention again the folding kind of dossier that you get, the folio, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
That is top notch. The board is quality, and the pieces are just, I mean, you have to see them to believe it. It's pretty impressive stuff.
Yes.
And I really like the gameplay because it's one of those, it's kind of like the other games where it's easy to pick up, but there can be a lot of strategy in this. You know, it's the perfect mix of an abstract strategy game plus, you know, with a lot of chess-like elements, and then you have that misdirection and deception thrown in there. And so, you know, it's like, I've always wanted to be good at chess and play chess, but I'm terrible at it.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of like, it has some chess elements into it, but it's also got all of this misdirection and deduction thrown in to where every game is different, and it's a heck of a lot of fun. It proves that sometimes the most, like, the simple concepts just executed really well can really be a great game. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, you know, this is Stronghold's third game they've put out, and they're 3-for-3, and they're getting on my map. Is, you know, there are a few companies out there that, whether it's almost everything they come out with or everything they come out with is solid, you know, I notice that. So, yeah. And I think, you know, gamers would do well to notice that as well.
Yep. Yeah, this was one that was good enough for me to go ahead and throw in a pre-order. So I went ahead to Stronghold Games website and pre-ordered this guy because I like it because as two-player games go, a game like Twilight Struggle, I'm going to struggle to get to the table very often, you know. What?
Stop using titles of games.
Boy, I'm not doing that on purpose, really. But I will struggle to get that one to the table that often, just because of the playtime and the complexity of it. Something like Cold War, CIA versus KGB will be a little bit easier. This game, I think, Confusion also falls in that category of, it's not a long game.
No.
It can be. I mean, I guess if, depending on how strategic you want to be, but I think that, you know, 30 to 45 minutes.
Oh, tops.
Tops, yeah. You know. It would be normal for this game. When I first saw this being played, which was at our Avon Game on Game Night with Jeremy Salinas and another guy who came to the game night, and I saw them sitting there with those notebooks in their hands, and they're crossing stuff off. It looks daunting. I mean, you look at what they're looking at, and you say, "Oh my gosh, this is going to be terrible," or "It's going to be a total brain burner," and it's just really not. At all. Well, I guess it is because it does have a deductive element to it. But I never felt like, oh my gosh, what does this piece do? I have no idea. Because, you know, most of the time you can narrow down your choices by half just by attempting a particular move.
And I would say Code 77 is more of a brain burn, but still not uncomfortably so. I think that is that is a tougher deduction game, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But this one scratches the same itch, and neither of them are so brain burning to frustration.
Yeah. And so that was one of the things I really liked about it that I was worried about was the brain burn element to it. And I don't really think it's that bad at all. I think it makes it very accessible to non-gamers, which is always an important thing to me, because if anyone's played chess or checkers or something like that before, setting up pieces like this is going to be, going to be familiar to them. And everybody that I've talked to, like at work and so forth, about this game has kind of given me like the raised eyebrow, like, huh, that sounds kind of interesting, you know. So I highly recommend this game. The production quality on it alone is worth it. It's very on par with things like with Survive and the other games they've come out with. And I love the artwork. It's got that, again, that espionage, you know, cloak and dagger sort of a feel to it. So That is Confusion, Espionage and Deception in the Cold War. I believe this is going to be coming out, from what I've read, around Origins, kind of June-July time frame.
And you can still pre-order it either through Stronghold or through your friendly professional game store, correct?
I believe that's correct. I know definitely through through Stronghold Games' website, but I'm and I'm sure, yeah, if you talk to your friendly professional game store, they might be able to hook you up with that as well. So it's coming. So go ahead and check that one out. Confusion.
In Soviet Russia, email reads you, and we have the game on inbox.
That's two right there.
Yeah, that's the second one. I don't know if I slipped into a bit of a German accent there. I don't know. But anyway, we've got an abbreviated game on inbox for you today. The first one comes from Gerald Demolig. I'm going to just go on a limb with that pronunciation.
Apologies if you're wrong.
Yeah, sorry. And they say, hey, Cody and John.
Hey, what's up?
My wife and I have been board gaming since last year. I think we got into it right after Gen Con last year. We are planning our trip to this year's Gen Con and are getting excited.
Woo.
We already ordered our badges. Good, good, good. And signed up for a couple events. Rune Age, Thunderstone, Ascension. Two out of three ain't bad.
I think they might be deck building fans. I don't know.
Maybe. What are some newbie tips you can give us on going to our first Gen Con? I know you guys are indie locals, so please give us some tips on good food around the area, too. Thanks, guys. Jer and Liz.
Okay.
So first time tips.
Come to Gen Con.
Yep.
It's a good idea.
I would say you've scheduled a few events. That's good. I would say don't overschedule. Right. I know that's a mistake I made, and I know a lot of people make their first Gen Con is they have scheduled events from 8 a.m. to midnight every day of the con, and you just get burnt out. So you sound like you're doing it right. You're just picking a few big events that you want to do. I would say buy a couple generic tickets, because that way you can they're flexible. If you see an event or flip through the catalog, something you like, you can go in and see if it's for you. And if you don't use them, you can always return them for system credit and use them towards event tickets for next year. My third tip would be make dealer room time. I mean, definitely. Yes. That's something we always talk about.
I always give the Thursday, the very first day of Gen Con, I devote the entire day just to looking in the dealer room. And then many hours after that too, because it really takes more than one day if you want to, you know, play a lot of demos and see everything that there is to see in the dealer hall. So
yeah.
Wear comfortable shoes.
Yes.
don't wear like strappy sandals or anything like that, unless those are your most comfortable shoes. You'll be on your feet an awful lot. And don't forget to eat. I mean, the first year that I came to Gen Con the entire time, I was so excited, and I overscheduled really badly, and I wanted to see everything. And I got to Gen Con. I didn't eat breakfast that morning, and I literally did not eat anything until like 4 o'clock that afternoon, and I felt like I was going to die.
Oh, wow.
Just because I was so excited. Oh, so much stuff to see. You know, you got to sort of pace yourself. As far as food places around, there's lots of great places in the city. Just for real quick stuff, the mall, the Circle Center Mall, which is sort of attached to where all the convention stuff is, has a really good food court, I think. Mm-hmm. It's got your typical food court options.
You can find something you like.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to eat there a lot because it's cheap, and I'm, you know, it's a local vacation for me, so I'm not spending big money. But lots of nice restaurants. There's a P.F. Chang's Chinese place. There's a, if you want to go even higher end, there's like the Fogo de Chão, which is a big Brazilian steakhouse. There's a really great seafood place called Oceaneer Seafood Room. It all depends on kind of what your price range is there, but lots of stuff within walking distance. You won't have any trouble finding good food places.
Yeah, a few other restaurants I'd mention. Two restaurants in the area really do up the Gen Con theme. The Ram Restaurant and Brewery, they really do it. The one that I would recommend is a place called Scotty's Brew House. It's just a few blocks from the convention center, but the owner there, they really do a good job of catering to gamers. They have geek movies playing. They have special like menus.
They had like the old Clash of the Titans playing last year when I was up there.
And very gamer-friendly. As John mentioned, the Circle Center Mall food court will be your best option. If you can go at a little off-peak hours, either take an early or a late lunch, you can avoid the drop off of crowds is really noticeable.
Yeah.
And then finally, if you wanted to spend a little more money for a local flavor, I would recommend a St. Elmo's Steakhouse. It's very close to downtown. It's pricey. It's not It's not cheap, but it's an indie staple and something you'll never forget, I would say.
Yeah, and absolutely. Oh, and on the lower end, one last food place, because I haven't eaten there in a long time because I used to work downtown and now I don't, so I don't get to go there. But there's a great hot dog place called King David's Dogs. It's on the corner of Pennsylvania and Washington Street. Yep. And it's just this little hot dog place that's got lots of kind of local flavor to it. It's only open like for lunchtime during weekdays, so you'd have to check it out on Thursday or Friday, but that's another good place too. So thanks for the email there, Jer.
Yeah.
All right, our next email is from Christopher Jones. He says his subject line is, "Afternoon, gents."
Good afternoon.
Just wanted to say that you produce a really great podcast, and you're definitely my first choice of gaming podcast.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. I've been working abroad recently for 7 months, so I've had the pleasure of catching up with the episodes I've missed. Out of curiosity, given that you're both big miniature gamers, have you... Well, I'm not sure
if I don't know if we're big, yeah.
We're getting there. Have you ever given Battleground Fantasy Warfare or Historical Warfare a whirl? I find that it offers all the enjoyment of miniature gaming without the expense and hassle of modeling and painting, and does so with a punchy rule set.
Punchy.
Keep up the good work, Chris. I have not. I do own this game, and unapologetically, I do have... It's just two little decks of cards that I have, it's one that I got for exactly that reason, but I haven't had a chance to get it to the table. But now that I know miniatures rules, I think we should really check it out because I think that we would understand it a lot better.
I've probably reached my ceiling with miniature game. I mean, we play War Machine, and we're going to get Dystopian Wars to the table here in the next month or so.
Yeah.
But I think I've reached my ceiling. I don't know if those D6G guys, they can play like 5 or 6 different miniatures games and have painted arms. I don't think I can do that. But. Yeah. We'll definitely give it a whirl. Thanks for the email, Chris.
Yeah, since it doesn't have any painting or modeling, it'd be easy to just set it up one day
and
just check it out. So, yeah, we'll try to get that one to the table soon. Thanks, Chris. And, one more thing. Is this our last thing? It is.
It is.
All right, and let's bring the music up.
Okay.
We know what that means, right? All right, it's time for another edition of the GM Academy.
I have to increase my gravitas.
That's right, put the robe on. Yeah, very good. All right, and so another entry of the GM Academy, this one from Alec Chapman. He says, "Dear Cody and John," he really means you, I'm sure. "Long-time listener, first time, et cetera, et cetera. Firstly, thank you for inspiring me to DM my first RPG for 18 years with your GM Academy sections and endless enthusiasm for the subject."
Oh, that's good to hear.
Oh, that is good to hear. "Luckily, I know several people who I managed to get interested, and we have had a couple of great fun evenings already doing the very starting adventure in the new Red Box. We've also invested in the rest of the 4E Essentials line. Not the most popular of lines with aficionados, I know.
Don't listen to them.
But the world is so familiar, I considered it less stressful to run." Oh, that's fine, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
"The highlight for me as a GM so far has been responding to the unexpected. In our second session, the adventurers were presented with a door with what sounded like guard patrols behind it. There's lots that they could have done, opened it a crack or gone through with swords drawn, searched for another way into the area or whatever. Two of the characters had an ego clash going, so they keep trying to outbrave the other one. So in a moment of bravado, they just knocked. I realize this seems obvious now, but I never even considered the possibility. The adventure assumes they just walk through the door after all. Thinking on my feet, though, I just invented a new doorman character with a serious chip on his shoulder.
Easy now.
Sorry. It's family show. Serious chip on his shoulder, and had great fun role-playing him. That's great. This guy didn't even exist 1 second earlier and just walked into my head with a bad temper and a good line of acidic put-downs. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
I tell this story to try and communicate to you that I think all board gamers should try and have a game of an RPG at some point. The ability to create three-dimensional worlds and characters without the occasional clunkiness of board-based role-playing games like Descent or Runebound is something that frees the mind wonderfully and leads to extreme fun."
Well said.
Yeah, well done there. So then Alec has a question here. He says, "My question is, as a newbie DM with a group of newbie players, I know this isn't ideal, but it was my only option. I have and am intending to continue, leaving the majority of the crunch aside for our first campaign. Specifically in terms of ammunition for ranged weapons and looting of bodies, have there been any other things that you have found worth putting aside for the first campaign with new players that could save a sticky situation later on? I'm of the opinion that it would be better to agree on these things early on. Yours, Alec Chapman."
Okay. It's a great idea. Basically, a lot of the little bookkeeping things, especially with new role players, you don't need to keep you know, like tabs on ammunition. That's a great thing. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of something that would be. Let me answer it a different way. You want to, with new players, you really want to keep the focus on the story. And is this moving the story forward? You know, it's like, yeah, you could have a side bit where if they don't have the right piece of equipment, that kind of moves the story forward. But you don't want the story to grind to a halt if no one has rope. You know, I think for a first campaign, it's not something necessarily that you would put aside, but I think you need to be very open to a lot of hand waving. You know, whatever keeps driving the story forward, you want to do. You know, if a lot of this is tied into a movement that's kind of like the say yes movement of GMing. You know, it's like say yes or roll the dice, to where if it's not something completely outlandish, if it's not something that's going to break the game or be overpowered, then just say yes. It's like, well, you know, it could be, you know, my fighter wants to go to the market and find this black sword, and he wants it done up a certain way. And instead of just going to the rule book and being like, well, there's a 15% chance by this table that there's, you know, it's like, no, it's like, that's fine. That's not going to break the, it's not overpowered. It's like, say you'll charge him 20 gold more and he'll do it. You know, just kind of have that mindset, say yes or roll the dice sort of thing where.
Now, say yes or roll the dice, you're making that sound like that's like is that a common, like,
I've heard that
GM
used
philosophy
before.
Idea. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not making that up.
Uh-huh.
But
it's catchy.
Yeah, it is. But you know, you really just need to focus on why you're there, to tell the story, to kind of have this shared narrative experience, and you know, don't get bogged down in the minutiae of it. And you know, people are, you know, the players are saying these things because they want to flesh out their character, and that's what you want to do as a GM, because that shows that they have interest in it, that they really want to engage in this world. And then you can just implement more crunch as you see fit, rules wise, but the first thing is tell a good story and have fun doing it. So it sounds like you're doing a lot of the right things, but just use as many rules as you need to keep the game going and no more. To go back to something I read in the Castles and Crusades book, it says the rules are your servant, not your master. Ooh. Remember that you're the GM, and that you can, if you need to make a ruling on the fly, just keep the game moving. You know, don't be overpowering, which it doesn't sound like you're going to be, but you know, don't waste 15 minutes looking up a rule. Make a ruling for then, move on, and then after the game, when you're not on everyone's time, you know, look it up and then find out what happened. So just keep it moving. That's what I say. It sounds like you're on the right track.
Yep, and having just done my first GM extent, I think movement is probably the most important thing that I would say, too. So not that my opinion matters in this world.
Oh, it's
so.
Okay.
All right, well, that's another great, great...
Oh, thank you.
Edition of the GM Academy. We want to invite you, if you ever want to get in touch with us and you know, send us a question or a comment or something for the GM Academy, mm-hmm. We would invite you to write us at the Game On Inbox.
That's gameoninbox@gmail.com.
That's right. And you can also always send us a voicemail or call the Game On hotline. That's
4138-GAME-ON.
That's right, 4138-GAME-ON. And also, you know, we don't really hype this up too much, but we have our guild on BoardGameGeek, mm-hmm. which you can access through our website, GameOnPodcast.com. And, you know, start up some discussions there. You know, you can, of course, communicate with us and email us. We'd love to hear from you. But we got all the other listeners that are signed up for the guild there. So start some threads there. We got an interesting thread on some Jones Theory rulings going on right now, mm-hmm. and some other things there. So I would definitely check that out.
In Soviet Russia, podcast listens to you. And then that's number three. That's what I committed to going
and
in.
Three and out there.
There we go. Nice. We hope you enjoyed this very chilly, this very misdirected.
Misdirected.
episode
misunderstood.
Of Game. Misunderstood. This very nuclear escalated episode of Game On with Cody and John.
Yes.
The Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer.
You know, we want to talk to you about one final thing as we bring the show to a close this episode. You know, we occasionally will make our little plea for donations. You know, it's always a great way to support the show is by clicking on the donation button. But, you know, you guys hear that every week. And, you know, we talk about sort of non-specific costs and getting games in and things like that. But we want to bring to you, because we've got such a great faithful listener base, and we really appreciate that you like what we're doing, and we love doing it for you. But we have actually a specific need that we would really like your help as listeners and as supporters of the show to help us with. You may remember last year we traveled to Myriad Games to New Hampshire.
Live Free or Die.
Back last October for an event called Extra Life, which was a 24-hour game marathon. It was primarily set for video games, but we participated on a board and card game capacity to raise money for the Children's Miracle Network of Hospitals. And so we were able to raise the whole event worldwide raised, I believe, close to like $500,000 mm-hmm. For these great children's hospitals. And so we have been invited to come back and participate in that event again this year. And we would really like to be able to go out and do that. But the one limitation is cost, mainly of plane ticket. And so things like hotel and food, we can sort of take care of that. But that big chunk of cost for two plane tickets to Manchester, New Hampshire, from where we live here in Indianapolis, you know, it's about $600 or $700. Yeah. And so this is just a sort of a specific need we want to bring to you, the Game On listeners, to see if you might be able to help us out with that. So we've, you know, that's coming up in October. We'd like to, of course, to reserve the plane tickets, you know, well before that if we could. So you know, like I said, we don't do this very often, but we would really love your help. Anything that you could help us with, you know, $1, $5, $10, $700, whatever, we would really, really appreciate. Just go to gameonpodcast.com, click on the donation button. It'll be a PayPal donation. And we just would really, really appreciate that. We want to be able to go out there, see some great podcasting friends. We'll hang out with the D6 Generation guys, with the Myriad Games Presentations folks, and I'll, you know, bring you some great content from that event, but also be able to help out these children's hospitals. So please go and check out the donation button, and every little bit helps.
Please do.
Yeah, thanks. So join us in 2 weeks where we're going to have another great episode of Game On. It'll be a little bit less chilly.
Yes.
It'll be a warmer episode. Yeah. And we'll have lots of great gaming content. Convention season starting to heat up. We'll have more to talk about with Origins and Gen Con and all the great stuff that's coming up in the summer. So until next time.
Game On.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on boardgamegeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at gameonpodcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on PulpGamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On.
Myriad Games sponsors our show on behalf of friendly professional game shows.
One-oh!
Radio edit.